Okay. Of extensions of DMFT is that in some sense they are not really unique. So what I would like to do is I would like to give you some flavor or some idea of what are the different clusters, which are extensions which are around, and how the approach, how one goes from single site to many sites. So, okay, so for that, what I decided to do is just simply review the single site DMFT construction in a way that immediately generalizes to clusters, and then we'll see where all the ambiguity are. So what is DMFT? We start with a lattice model, for example, the Hubbard model, so we have some Tijs and some Us, and what we would like to do is we would like to reduce that to a single site problem which describes an electron in a medium. So there are various ways of doing that, and because there are various ways of deriving the dynamical mean field equations, each one of those ways generalizes to clusters. So the simplest way is by using what is called the cavity construction, and this is more or less explained in the review with Antoine George. What we do is physically very simple. We take a single site in the lattice, and we ask, if we integrate out all the other electrons, what kind of effective Hamiltonian or effective action do we get to describe the local physics at this site? And what the dynamical mean field theory tells you is that the single site action or Hamiltonian that describes that is an Anderson impurity model that depends on how we describe the medium, and it has a form which Thierry Giammarchi discussed in the context of the chain DMFT. It has some retardation, it has a U. So it basically preserves the local physics pretty much exactly, and the effects of all the medium is replaced by a Bath function. And that Bath function, you can think of it, it has the form that we have in the atomic limit, and it has then a hybridization function which describes how the electron delocalizes. And like in any mean field theory, just to close the equations, all we need is some way to close the equations. And the way that we close the equations is by taking this effective action, which depends on G0, from there computing the local Green's function, which depends on G0, computing an auxiliary object, which is called the self-energy, which also depends on G0 in the usual way, and then writing the DMFT equations, which is some nonlinear equation, which determines the G0 and involves this lattice. Okay? So this is by now very standard, and it's very much like a CPA-like construction. It gives us the best single-site medium. Okay? So now we would like to simply generalize all that to the case that we have clusters, and the most... Yes?
Can I ask a question?
Yes?
One question?
Yeah, this is a discussion session, so please interrupt me.
Whether or not it was generally so that if the self-energy was k-dependent, that the DMFT was an exact, and you guys taught me that that wasn't true or wasn't always true. Is the distinction whether the interaction is local or not local, or what was?
Okay.
So
let me answer this question the way I'm doing this thing here. If I had kept all the terms in this effective action derivation, if I had kept here some retardation in the quartic term and generated all the other things, this approach would be exact. The approximation that we're making is twofold. We're neglecting spin retardation and all these quartic terms which would be generated here. And given that assumption, we are determining the sigma in this way.
I think the question had to do with if U was not single site, if
I will go to the non-single site in a second. All I'm trying to explain now is the single site. And then, what you can say is that if the Green's function, which generally is I omega plus mu minus T of K, yes?
I think what Jim wanted to ask here is whether K, if you have a system where your self-energy is K independent,
yes,
because of what reason soever,
yes,
whether this means that the system is described by DMFT, and I think the answer is not necessarily.
I would say that if you know a priori, in principle the self-energy is a function of omega and k. If you know for some reason, for example, experimentally, if you know that the k dependence is unimportant, and if you know what is the hopping, if you know this functional form, I believe that the DMFT gives you, in a well-defined sense, the best local approximation for this sigma. So if you know the u...
I think you could construct a system which has a k-independent self-energy and which is not, which has some corrections to DMFT. Yes.
No, but if you know the hopping, and if you know the U, and if that's, and you have, as a theorist, you have to compute a local self-energy just with those hoppings and that U, and you know that the U is local, I believe that out of all the possible self-energies, the DMFT gives you the best one. So I'm taking a theoretical perspective, not a phenomenological perspective, that we have a model, and we have certain constraints, and within these constraints, we're trying to do the best job. So I would say, if somebody give you T of K, and somebody give you U, if these are your parameters, and you have the constraint that the sigma is local, you can write a functional of sigma and GII, and you can show that the DMFT equations extremize that functional. So in that sense, from a theoretical point of view, I think that the DMFT is the best local approximation, even in finite dimensions. But again, this is a question of semantics. I can write down for you the functional. You can perhaps invent some other functional, which...
One of the D corrections.
Yes.
One of the D corrections has a K-dependent part.
Sure.
Let's say a K-independent part.
Sure.
And you could, I think, construct
a different functional
where the k-dependent part just cancels,
sure,
for whatever reason. Still, the one of the omega, at least it hasn't been proven. I think we can agree on that.
Yeah. Well, as I said, what one can show is that if you have the TIJs, if you have a U, if you assume that the self-energy is local in a well-defined sense, in the sense that there's some functional underlying this, gives you the best self-energy. It's given by those equations here.
So we can distinguish between best and exact.
Well, the assumption of k-independence is never exact, as we'll go in a second.
What is the meaning of exact?
And this is...
make an approximation to begin with. For any given model...
This is not going to work out, I can see that.
Okay, I frankly think that if we wanted to discuss this specific issue, we would have to... Jörg.
Yes.
Okay.
So, first you can construct the model with given T, I say, and U. It's also pretty obvious that you cannot simply, without discussion, in addition, assume that sigma is local.
Of course.
Just a moment. I'm coming to my question. So, can you discuss what are the circumstances when that last assumption,
yes,
that becomes good? And finally, what are the circumstances when that last assumption becomes exact?
Okay, so there's a mathematical answer and there's a physical answer to this problem. The mathematical answer is if we start with the d-dimensional lattice, if we scale the TIJs the way that Metzner and Folhart constructed it, by 1 over square root of d, or 1 to the d to the power I minus j over 2, where this is basically the Manhattan distance between the points on the lattice. And now you take d going to infinity, all these assumptions are exact. This is just a mathematical answer. Now, you probably want some physical answer because people are comparing these things to experiment. And my belief is that what's lost in this method is the effects of jij, which is a super exchange, in the paramagnetic phase. And when the magnetic correlations are short-ranged, this is a physically sensible thing to do, for example, in a paramagnetic phase. And when you start having low-range spin-spin autocorrelations in the system, when you're getting close to, for example, quantum critical point, and those spin fluctuations are feeding back on the electrons, this assumption totally breaks down. Okay? But what I wanted to discuss is what happens if we try to do this construction directly on, now, instead of taking here, instead of a single point, a unit cell. How do we generalize that? And I should say, this is simply the CPA equations, and there's a very long, long history on how one extends or tries to extend CPA to take into account finite range correlations. And what I will present is the many-body version of this, at least indicate where are the pitfalls and what are the options that we currently have. Okay? So that's what I wanted to discuss, but I think that so, all right. So now, what one would like to do now is to take the simplest generalization would be to now do exactly what I've done here. So perhaps I should keep this and save a little bit of time. Except that instead of taking here the single site, I will simply now take, for example, a plaquette or some bigger cluster. Okay? And I will try to do precisely this cavity construction, in what I will do is I will consider all these guys as my local guys. So I would add here some index I and j, where I and j run over the cluster. And then the problem is, how do we determine the G0? What's sort of the best way to determine an environment for computing just the local properties inside the cluster? So now what I would like to compute here is the Gij, where I and j belong to the cluster. All right? And the simplest approximation, or the simplest generalization that one can do, is simply to say that the impurity retains this form, but now the indices I and j describe a cluster, so we still neglect the renormalization of all the Euler correlation functions here. And now one can try to write a matrix generalization of this equation. The way that this is done is by, just like it's done in what it's called the molecular CPA in the context of disorder systems, one goes from the index I, which describes the site, to two coordinates. One is the supercell, and one is an index alpha inside the supercell. And this is the supercell index. One writes the Tij in this new supercell notation. This is just a rewriting. And then basically one takes these equations here, but now these are matrix equations. So sigma here and the G0 are a matrix in the I and J index. One can show that this generalization actually obeys causality. So if one solves these equations, the sigma has the necessary analytic properties. And the first thing that one finds that is sort of puzzling or
so you say a single site.
No.
Interaction, or does it become a cluster?
Now U lives inside the cluster. So now this index I runs inside the cluster, and this index I and J runs inside the cluster.
The
so
there's more orbitals in there. So what about the CI up, CI down, the creation and annihilation operators? They must now have orbital index or something like that?
They have a site index. They have a site index. Yes. So instead of before they had no site index, because it was a single site, so one dropped it.
Okay.
Now they have a site index because I and J run
in the cluster.
In the cluster.
Right. So So I think George is unhappy that it's all the same I.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Where? Yeah. Where is only the same I? Okay. Here, here.
All C's have the same I.
In the U.
Could there be a non-local?
Yes, here it costs you nothing, for example, to put in your favorite interaction, for example, a nearest neighbor Coulomb repulsion.
Okay. It's clear enough, it's just
that.
Okay.
So, U is on diagonal, it's not.
Here I took just the Hubbard U, but you can consider, for example, a model that also has a V and that has also been treated.
Transform your cluster so that it would be, shall we say, a U that would be a cluster U.
A cluster U is the nearest neighbor repulsion and generalizations. Yes. Well, here I took a single site, a single band Hubbard model. All this can be done also for multibands, and then you will have your orbital indices. Yeah.
If you had a Vij, how would you treat the Vij between the clusters?
At this point, the simplest approximation that you would do is simply drop them out. The second approximation, which is connected with the generalization of this thing, is what is called the extended EMFT. In the extended EMFT, and there will be a discussion session on this, I think tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, what you do is you first decouple this. You first make it local by introducing a Hubbard-Stratton-Ridge field, and then you do the EMFT on the Hubbard-Stratton-Ridge field, which now becomes local. You can always write a non-local interaction as a local interaction mediated by a phonon. And then you do the MFT on that. So that's the second way of doing it. Anyway, that's... So now, the question that that strikes you here is that by doing that, by selecting these sites here, you've broken translation invariant. Okay, so that's the main difficulty with this approach. And then what you should remember is that, in some sense, what's underlying this is sort of a cavity construction. If you had not neglected all these higher order terms, then what you would have gotten has to be translation invariant, because this is essentially an exact construction. So since you broke the translation invariance, you have to restore it. And here, you see for the first time that there are really two concepts. There is the cluster self-energy, sigma. So what I wrote here should be sigma hat is really the cluster self-energy. And then there's the lattice self-energy. And that's, I think, something that we'll go back to. And the lattice self-energy, the way that you get that is simply by projecting the translation invariant part of your cluster self-energy. So that's basically what I would call CDMFT. This is not... There's a second way to try to deal with this breaking of translation invariant. I should say that this matrix W has to be positive definite in order to maintain causality. And what you would like is you would like that in the limit that your cluster gets very, very large, then this projection should go to unity. So if you sum over all alpha and beta, this goes to 1. The simplest way of doing this job is by taking this W, something like 1 over the size of the cluster.
Can
yes?
I think, another
yes.
So in your cluster, which, of course, I would say a half Hilbert band, would on the average have 4 electrons on it, if you was the large, well, on the average, but also 4 electrons on it. Do you take into account then, so are your alpha, beta, do yes. they label
sites?
Say the sites, or do
yes.
they label
the sites
eigenstates, the exact diagonalization eigenstates?
The sites inside the cluster.
Is that not another way of doing it?
There are many ways of doing this. I'm trying to point out what are the.
Because then the self energy would also depend, because the number of electrons could fluctuate anywhere from.
It will. It will. The main difference between this and an exact diagonalization approach, in an exact diagonalization approach, what's the difference between this and an exact diagonalization approach? In an exact diagonalization approach, you would get some finite size cluster and you try to diagonalize it.
No, that's not what I mean.
No, no, but
exactly diagonalize the pore site.
But what are you doing here?
You're
yes, okay. It's a different, in fact, one of the ways that we solve this equation is by doing that. So, but So the difference with the exact diagonalization is that simply here we are sort of putting this in a bath and we're allowing the number of electrons to fluctuate. So in other words, instead of doing open boundary conditions or periodic boundary conditions, we do what it's called dynamic mean field boundary conditions, that we don't consider a cluster to be isolated, but we consider the cluster to be part of a medium. And here we see some connection with the DMRG approach, which was invented by Steve White, because in the DMRG approach, in some sense, it's very similar in spirit. What you would like is not to do an exact diagonalization of a cluster in isolation, but to do a cluster inside a medium which is described by a density matrix. The difference with the DMRG approach is that in White's approach, the density matrix is computed by doing an exact diagonalization of an even bigger system. And that's really the bottleneck. What the dynamic mean field theory does, it says, okay, let's pretend somehow that our variable delta is somewhat close to Gaussian, which is an approximation which is quite good. It's exact in large dimensions, it's quite good in three dimensions. And let's use the knowledge that the system is periodic and that the bath is Gaussian to infer what my density matrix is. Okay? So now, as I said, the main thing that people don't like about this is that the sigma is non-translation invariant. And there's a second thing that you can do, which is called the dynamical cluster approximation that was introduced by Mark Jarrell and by Krishnamurti and his collaborators. And the simplest way to understand that is to go back to these equations that we wrote here. And to observe that this T here, that if I solve these equations, my sigma alpha beta now is really a full matrix, because my Hopping, the Hopping matrix element written in this supercell notation, is not a cyclic matrix. It cannot be a cyclic matrix because the Hopping is not in a periodic cluster, but it's really in an infinite cluster. So one way to get a periodic self-energy directly from the outset is to transform these Hoppings so that this matrix is cyclic by sort of modifying slightly the Hoppings. One can show that this modification doesn't cause any difference in the thermodynamic limit. And once you do that, now your self-energy is cyclic in real space, which means that it's diagonal in cluster momentum. And then you can think of this also as a discretization method in momentum space. Because then what you can think that you're doing here is simply to take your Brillouin zone, and I think I should finish very soon, and then think that this is your Brillouin zone, and what you do is you take your sigma in momentum space, and then you say that this is equal to some sigma of k alpha, where alpha is something that labels the different pieces of the Brillouin zone. So each one of those things we can call B sub alpha. So we have a self-energy which is discretized in momentum space. So okay, so this is the second method. This is also a causal method. And finally, there is a periodic cluster method that was used by Lichtenstein and Katzenelson to discuss the issue of D-wave superconductivity in the Hubbard model, for example, a topic that was also covered by Jarrell et al. And the difference with the first approach is that the difference with the DCA is that now in this self-consistent equations, which we can write now, for example, in one can diagonalize this in cluster momenta, what one does is one really involves the self-energy. Now, one interpolates this sigma smoothly in k-space, and then one involves it directly in that equation there. So in this method, there's no difference between cluster self-energy and lattice self-energy. Okay, so that's basically the some of the options that are available, I was going to cover a different way of how to get at this using functionals, but I won't do that because I want to give enough time for the next speaker. I should say that the issues, there are technical issues involved. One is the method causal, how is the translation invariant restored, how all these methods basically have to converge to the thermodynamic limit, but they are somewhat different because the convergence is very different. In this CDMFT, you can think that your delta of I omega really lives on the boundary. So it's really a cavity field. When you do DCA, your delta of omega, in order to get the translation invariance, your delta of omega is uniform. So there's a trade-off between having a uniform, something which is periodic from the outset, and having this delta on the boundary as one would like. So those are the technical issues. The physical issues are the following. I mean, we know that we have gotten fairly interesting physics from the MFT. I would say the most surprising thing is this issue that George Zawadzki always comes back to, that the model, if we take a model with a lot of frustration, we get in the TU plane a first order line. And around this first order line, so I would say we have first order line, and then we have a very strong transfer of spectral weight near that point. And the question is, so this is when we have frustration. And the question is this really an artifact of this taking a local approximation, or if we try to now do something with two sides or four sides, what is the theory? We have a complete understanding of this analytically and numerically. We would like to know what happens when we change and we expand the size of the cluster. And I think that what I believe happened is that if you have strong frustration, I believe a lot of this will survive. And if you don't have frustration, then this immediately breaks down and the long range order shows immediately in those clusters. And that's really the main difference between single site and cluster. I would like to show just one transparency to conclude, to show that one can actually compute things. And this is mainly to illustrate how bad is the DMFT when we have a situation which is not frustrated. So this is a comparison. Now to solve these impurity models, we're using exact diagonalization, and what's compared here is the single site DMFT and the two site DMFT. So the single site and the quantity that we're computing is the gap, which can be computed analytically, but we also have done many other comparisons with spectral functions using White's DMRG method. So what's plotted here is the gap which vanishes in the single site DMFT approximation. That's because, as George keeps insisting, I mean, this is a mean field approximation, and therefore it will have a transition no matter which dimension you look at, and therefore you're going to have a mod transition even in one dimension. But this is immediately changed when you go to the two-site case, and then it's not surprising that one can get the something which is very similar to the exact solution for large U, but it's very nice that this also works for small U. And the point I want to make is that all the structure associated with the transition, the coexistence, etc., is totally wiped out at zero temperature. And if you go to three sites, what will happen is you still have a first order transition, but now the region of coexistence is very small. If you go to four sites, then you're going to get this thing again, etc. Now, so this is part of the answer to the question. I believe that when you don't have frustration and the spin-spin autocorrelation function is sizable, like in this case, in one dimension, the spin-spin correlations do have power law, then this is the single site approximation is not accurate. But what I believe is also the case is that when you are at high temperatures and you are in a region where you have frustration, I believe that the dynamical mean field theory is quite correct. And the reason why I'm making this statement is because of experience of trying to get those hot spots or strongly K-dependent self-energy is extremely hard. One really have to fine-tune parameters. So I believe that we will be able to show soon that this thing is really a robust feature of a system which has strong frustration, which doesn't allow the spin-spin autocorrelations to build. That can only be true at finite temperatures. It will break down as we lower the temperature. So this is just to introduce, to set up the discussion, and I skipped something I was going to explain, which is how can one derive all those approaches using functionals, which is just complementary to the cavity.
Okay, let's take a few questions.
Okay.
I have a question concerning your one-dimensional CD-like
yes.
calculation. Are you saying that when you go from DMFT to the two-side
yes.
CDMFT, you directly jump from critical view
yes.
to
yes. Yes. So this at t equal to zero, having these spin-spin correlations is a brutally singular perturbation, which completely wipes out the mode transition. But I believe this is because we did this at zero temperature, and because this is an extreme case, which is one dimension with the spin-spin correlations, we know that they're large. And what I believe we'll be able to show, which is that at finite temperatures and with frustration, this stuff here will survive. So that's what I believe. But again, this is a discussion session because the problem is completely open.
George.
Is it because the spin-spin correlation point, do you see as soon as you go to two, a cluster of two,
yes.
you have the possibility of forming singlet states?
Yes.
Which, of course, is the nice thing you want to do. That doesn't require a long range.
I agree.
It's actually a short range.
Yes.
And that's, of course, the dominant thing in the real one-dimensional
yes.
problem.
And it's absent in DMFT, in single site.
It's absent in single site
yes.
DMFT. But those kinds of short-range singlet-like or these kinds of short-range correlations, those are things which also occur in higher dimensions.
Yes.
I mean, we always have, you know, the argument as to whether or not you have resonant valence bond-like near resonant valence bond-like states that the two-dimensional spin-one-half systems and things like that, which also would require one to go to that kind of thing. Because these singlet, well, you know Anderson's argument.
Yes.
You know that the long-range Niel state is on in a mean field level, the lower energy state, if Z, the number of mirrors.
I agree.
Great.
And there will be some energy scale which is associated with that. I expect that this is J divided by some big number in a frustrated system. And I believe that the approach has to break down when we go to scales which are of the order of J divided by that number. I mean, the way I rationalize... Yeah?
Is it correct to say that in an ordinary single cycle,
yes.
you could never really get a singlet state in
correct.
The sense of it?
Well, you can form a single, the way that you form the single state is by quenching the local spin with the medium via the hopping. The thing you cannot do is quench that spin by finding a nearest neighbor and form a singlet.
You can have
this,
it.
We're getting the first taste when we look at the two sides of the plaquette.
You can have a singlet metal.
Yeah.
Not a singlet insulator.
Sure.
and just maybe a clarifying remark on the word frustration. I mean, this has to be taken as meaning any kind of fluctuations that will reduce the tendency to short-range ordering and that will reduce the correlation length.
So what's absent in single-site DMFT is the short-range order. Once the short-range order becomes dominant, the single-site approximation will break down. The hope is that in oxides, because you have all these competing J's, like you explained to me years ago in V2O3, you have some guys which are ferro, some guys which are anti-ferro, and they're very near each other. Because of this competition between those J's, when you are around this point, the system doesn't form, that cannot really lock into a singlet, and that allows the DMFT approximation to work. Gradually, as you lower the temperature, eventually you'll decide which one is the largest J and how you want to correlate, and that will be the temperature at which the single side will break down.
Okay. Balash and then Hilbert.
Yeah, this is just a comment. Recently, in collaboration with Hugh Stockton and James Ouellette, we've done quite a few static version of this cluster generalization. In other words, non-local CPA.
Okay.
Precisely in the manner that you're describing. In two cases, one was a D-Day superconductor. It would be a high-TC material with a zinc impurities. And as the cluster got large enough so that it could include the particular impurity neighborhood of the zinc atoms, we saw the peaks that Shingles Davis sees in his experiment. And in the single site CPA approximation, of course, it wasn't there because the impurity states form on a cluster. So that worked out very well. The other application is for binary alloys, where of course this allows you to do short range order, and in particular the two side resonances, the nearest neighbor resonances, they're all there. And for instance, if you're looking for the split band regime, which is one of the things that the CPA does very well in splitting, but it gives it a little bit too soon. Once the cluster as were introduced, then there are states going into the place where there should be some states. And again, the results, the recovery, which one knows to be there from very large cluster calculations and the like. So the method seems to be very robust and works and gets it. Short-range correlations are wonderfully described by
him. Great. And again, I mean, I think the spirit is that one tries to describe, instead of doing an exact diagonalization, one tries to do it in a medium. And that really helps a lot to capture the physics, because it brings a lot of self-consistency in. I mean, and you bring the short-range order, as you describe, and many things which are not in single site. The hope is that the comparison with the experiment that many people are doing is only done in a situation where the method is really justified, when the SISJ is not that large.
Brief question by Hilbert, and then we move to Sasha's contribution.
I'm sorry it took so much. Yes.
And this is the local property. And the question I have, does that survive in the transfer?
Yes. And I give an opinion. The opinion is, if you start with a model which has enough frustration or the temperature sufficiently high that you don't need to worry about very strong spin-spin neighbor correlations, I believe that condo peak is there to stay. Perhaps not with height 1, with some reduced height, and that will explain, for example, in a good metal, the exchange between two sites is almost meaningless. The correlation between the spins is whatever you get from the Pauli principle. So there, I think the method is completely justified. If you go to situations where an RVB-like description becomes important, or when you're close to long-range order, the first thing that the cluster method tells you is you're ordered, and therefore you completely wipe out that peak by opening a gap. So my belief is that the robustness of those results, which are tied to the existence of a first order transition, are intimately connected to the presence of strong frustration. And in support of that, I should mention that Masa Imada showed very beautiful numerical work at the beginning of this workshop, in which he actually studied in two dimensions models with strong frustration, and he was able to find for the first time in a two-dimensional model this first order transition that we predicted using dynamic and mean field theory. So that's one more element in support of the idea that when you have strong frustration, you can have that scenario. When you get rid of the frustration, that's completely wiped out.
I think we'll keep the other comments and remarks for the end of this discussion session. Let's move to Sasha's talk.
Okay. All right, Sasha, this is yours.
So I would just like to show a few examples of cluster calculation, and especially for today's meeting, where it was a lot of V2O3, I would like to maybe show a few preliminary results. So this is why the list of collaborators is big, and it's really, I learned a lot from my friends Kuznetsov, whom we did this cluster calculation, Antoine, Gabi, and Marcelo, we did a lot of tests with cluster method. Then Tanusri and Olu, so teach us how to use an MTO or use these things. And of course, Vladimir Anisimov and Augsburg group, Jim Allen, was very important for V2O3 discussion. So this is just simple things. So there are a lot of systems where you could view like a cluster compound, and this is why maybe we need to go beyond. So there is a few list of work. There is a nice work of two-side or double betel lattice, and this was PhD students of Gabi and Andrei Rukinstein, then Mark Jarrell with DCA, different cluster approximation. And today you've heard talk by Thierry about chain DMFT, which I also somehow consider as a cluster generalization. So if you have any, so free cluster or periodic cluster, so you could map this to solution of cluster model in some bath. So free cluster or molecular cluster is simple, Gabi describes this, but sometimes, of course, we were not happy that if you calculate self-energy here, we put here only hopping and not zero. DCA just tried to cue this problem in some strange way, just changing effective hopping. So hopping is change in DCA. Why we want to keep hopping in real space? We would like to maybe do it somehow translation in invariant. And Gabi just explained that you could go from a cluster to lattice self-energy. So the only one thing is probably how to close this DMFT equation. And then probably one of the reasonable solution would be to use really cavity construction in this case, because as soon as your self-energy become k-dependent, you could easily show that effective impurity model and effective cavity model is different. It's only for free cluster. You could start from cavity model and come back to impurity. Okay, so simple model. So maybe a few tests. So I did a very simple test of four-side cluster. So and did it first of all with exact diagonalization is four-side, and then the two-side in dynamical cluster approximation or just in molecular cluster. And this is just a very broad spectral function for half field model with u equal to bandwidth. And you see, so the Bose method produces feature of four-side cluster where you have some kinds of pseudo gap as we discussed.
But the peak at EF is gone.
Yeah. This is not a highly frustrated system in half field. If you have frustration, you still restore quasi-particle peak. Okay, so then you could apply this cluster method to problem of this short-range antiferromagnetic fluctuation, maybe short-range D-wave fluctuation. So what we did, so we use simple 2x2 cluster and introduce antiferromagnetic order parameter and D-wave order parameter, which in general, of course, is a matrix, but main non-zero component is just sitting on side because it's really D-wave, minus delta, delta, minus delta, delta. And so with this cluster formalism, you could just calculate this spin, generalized spin Green function, which will be 4x4 matrix in a side space and 2x2 in a spin space with the normal Green function, anomalous Green function, and the same for self-energy. And then you find that, so this D-wave fluctuation for anomalous Green function and even some antiferromagnetic fluctuation in this 2x2 cluster survive. And I don't know, the very simple reason why it survived, it's also clear, because antiferromagnetic fluctuation is mainly sitting in a local Green function, while D-wave fluctuation is sitting in non-local Green function. So they separate in the space. So it's very robust feature that some antiferromagnetic fluctuation and superconducting fluctuation could live in this 2x2 cluster. Okay, another example which I want to show you is this spin ladder. And we know that there is this, of course, spin gap below TC, which is 34 Kelvin. This is a quarter filled two-leg ladder. But the problem is that, of course, it stays insulating till a very high temperature. And this is why we try also to model this with a two-side cluster. So we use this cluster on a rank, which is also non-trivial because T-perp is the largest hopping in this case. Of course, we also could argue why we choose this cluster, because maybe it's not a tree. It's the same maybe problem as we discussed as V2O3, but we say that this is the main hopping, so we choose this two-side cluster, which and two-side cluster has one electron. So if you do low temperature calculation, you can, with any mean field like LDA plus U, anything, could find a charge ordering and spin ordering. But we want to reproduce the same gap state above ordering temperature. So we choose this two-side cluster with one electron per side. But in this case, of course, we keep U and V because it's a quarter, like a quarter field.
It's one electron per two side.
One electron per two side. Per two side.
Yeah.
Okay. Then it's just cluster. We use exact diagonalization in Xane. In a matrix form, you saw this equation. So we just map this to effective two-side cluster in a media. And we use a matrix bath, which is also effective two-side bath. We use exact diagonalization. So we try to do our best in electronic structure. So we start from Ole Anderson and MTOs, which Tanusri did. So we fit electronic structure, which is a metal in this case. And okay, skip the phase diagram and put in our model with a two different V. We are not sure about Vs. So U is we obtain the U V constrained LDA, and then we, of course, produce a nice insulating phase with the gap for larger V, which is of order of 1 electron volt.
Which V is this V?
It's inter-side V.
On
the
rack?
Yeah.
Okay, there's another on the layer.
We skip it. Yeah, it's only keep the V on the rank.
How? Is the charge order the same, or is there no charge order?
No, this is no, this is no spin, no charge order state.
No, no,
it's
no,
like
no,
a...
No,
No, yeah, yeah. It's like a quarter field insulator. Okay, and finally, 5 minutes, come back to V2O3. If there is a pair or if there is no pair, of course, it's a very hard question, and then the answer will be if you will try some pairs. Before we try, we couldn't understand. Of course, the structure, as George said, there is some missing atom here, but this distance is the smallest, so there is another 3 atom in the plane. So what we try to do, again, we try to use the best density functional fitting for our Hamiltonian, and then try to map this system to a two-side cluster in some effective matrix bath. Each side has a 3 orbital now, 2 EG and 1 EYG. And of course, there is a big green function which couples these two sides with A1G symmetry. Okay, so let's look first on NMTR. So this is LDA. So you see that this is some, we start from non-magnetic. Yeah, it's not LDA plus U. So then, of course, as George said, that this is T2G state. This is EG pi and A1G. So Tanusri did NMTO downfolding. So now this is only T2G part, and this is full Hamiltonian. And the green one, which is lying on top of this, is a T2G downfolding. So it's almost perfect with some 3 energy. So now we have 12 by 12 effective Hamiltonian, which we downfold. If we Fourier transform this in real space, it gives us effective Hopping integral, which is different from, of course, LDA plus U results, because in LDA plus U, you shift this state each of other. And because Hopping is not a direct Hopping, as we know, but Hopping via oxygen, then, of course, because delta P did change, the effective Hopping is also changed. But it's also interesting question from which starting point we need to start, from pure LDA or with some correlation. So we have trigonal splitting. So this is again our DZ or Z Hopping in A1G, which is the largest. And this is EGEG. So, and of course, it's a dilemma because this Hopping is 2.5 times larger than EG, but there is a three pairs in a plane. So it's complicated problem. So in any case, we start first with this pair. So Sasha Patiria spent a lot of time because, of course, this double side DMFT is order of magnitude harder than single side, and we try to compare this with a single side DMFT. So this is a metallic phase, insulating phase. We choose the same parameters as in custom health calculation. So red one is EG density of states, blue one A1G. Full line is a cluster, and dotted line is a single side. So if you compare this to curve, you will see that a cluster effect is larger in insulating phase than in metallic, and which is also consistent with the fact that here you have a different orbital fluctuation in insulating phase. So it's some kinds of dynamical orbital ordering which produce a difference between single side and double side. And I think it's in the right direction because now the gap become a little bit larger than in a single side, which is probably always was a big problem with single side DMFT. And the main effect, of course, is it should become to this A1G orbital if you compare the single side to double side. Of course, we need to do much more work and compare magnetic correlations, because we know that what is really different is a magnetic correlation. Yeah.
That's a question, actually. So in this pair now, the C-axis pair, just like we heard from Gabi, that in the pair that he considered in the one-dimensional was actually a singlet state that you ended up with. Does it end up with a spin antiferal state as far as the pair is concerned? What are the correlations there? I bet you it is.
It's not a trivial question because I check it with the bulk. Yeah? You know that in antiferromagnetic insulating phase is really this pair is ferromagnetic, but in metallic phase is some kinds of spin density wave which is more close to antiferromagnetic. So this is exactly effect of orbital fluctuation to exchange interaction. We still didn't analyze the effect. So up to now, we use a really paramagnetic solution of this cluster. But again, this is what really differ magnetic fluctuation in magnetic and insulating phase. And it should come from this some cluster. Maybe the larger cluster, maybe this. So we don't know a priori. Of course, if we think about this Frederick Miller model, then you said that probably this effect is important for magnetic fluctuation. That's almost it. So,
but isn't such a bad thing that you look at the cluster, the two side cluster, and you get a certain internal exchange and ordering, and then you find that when you connect the cluster to everybody else, that everybody else tells it to readjust itself.
Sure.
I don't know if that's a terrible thing.
No, why?
But in the insulator phase, maybe it's fine. And in the metal phase, where you don't have the long range order, then perhaps the system goes back closer to what the cluster wants to do.
Yeah, but it's all sitting.
I completely agree, but DMFT will not do that for you. because there is no enough long range. It will not readjust the spin correlations inside the cluster because of what's happening with the medium that it's coupling.
I'm not agree because we have a medium. Maybe Gabby will prove we could try a different periodic conditions.
That's different. Then you're getting a different cluster.
Yeah. No. The cluster is the same, but self-consistent condition. Because we know knowledge what magnetic ordering is in our cell. We could try a different magnetic ordering. Okay. It's the same like in density functional. We could try a different ordering and then choose what is the lowest one. It's still mean field.
Okay, so are there more questions? More topics for discussion?
I guess I want to make a remark, and I hope my memory is correct there. I'm taking the two talks together and some comments. So that's a question of what sort of spin-spin correlations do you find in a simple SP-type metal? There was a very early thesis done under Wigner's supervision by a person who I think is still active, or at least was until recently. His last name is Stern. I don't remember his first name. At IBM? Yeah, Frankster. Frankster. That's it. Thank you. That was his thesis, as I remember. Of course, we're talking about many decades ago. As I remember it, the objective was to compare the cohesive energies or total energies of conventional metallic state, let's say the Wigner-Seitz type calculation. I think it was done for simple alkalis like sodium, and the energy for an assumed classical anti-ferromagnetic arrangement, and those were extremely close. Okay, that's the one remark, and I think, you know, something to keep in mind. What the implications are, I think, is very complicated. There is something similar in a different kind of physics altogether. If you take point charges in a uniform background and you compare different spatial lattices like BCC, FCC, and so on, the energies agree to four or five places. Does this mean that all these lattices are very unrobust? I don't think necessarily. Okay, that's a comment. Now I want to ask, really start with a comment and then ask a question. I've seen many, many calculations, I think Georgia must know about them more than I, but some of them were done at Oak Ridge, where I think you worked for a while. and they thought about clusters in a different geometric sense, to which I relate rather well. For example, let's take a specific example, a copper nickel alloy, and that was studied. I think it's completely miscible, or very highly miscible, and the lattice has the same structure, FCC, and about the same spacings, very slight differences. And the clusters they looked at were clusters of 13 atoms. FCC has 12 nearest neighbors, so you had a central atom and its nearest neighbors. And then you looked at local properties of the central atom. Central atom in such a cluster is insulated by a full nearest neighbor shell from the outside. Now the outside could be a medium, some, and there could be some self-consistent calculation. And then you looked only at the properties of the central atom. And this this gives quite good results. Because that central atom is shielded from the medium, which of course is a very approximate description of the real thing. So it's a different geometry, and remembering those things, I'm worried about the clusters that you show, because most of the atoms have, you know, as nearest neighbors, half of the nearest neighbors, roughly, are the medium, which is very bad. And that troubles me, and I want your comments, well, yours and also Gabby's.
Sure, you're exactly right, Walter. So, it's exactly what we want to point. If you increase the cluster and calculate the local properties, and if the cluster is large enough, only local properties, then it will be very good. But in real space cluster, we can do this. And we could change maybe, alloying atom, so it's real atom. So you really could operate. While if your cluster is in K-space, so you couldn't, it's by definition all periodic. So it's really good comment, and we can do this in real space. So we can do exactly this, maybe sort inside cluster and look at the many body function at the center. But when we can do this, it's another good question.
I think.
We looked at what Walter is saying, something like a
five side cluster.
And at least half feeling was not that much difference for the local wind function. At least in the temperature with TNC as I can.
Balash?
It should be added to all these cluster calculations, but the trouble with them after the loss is that rates were scattering back from the boundaries. And so it became very important to kind of, if you just take a cluster and nothing outside, then rates scatter back and it's back scattering and causes the unwanted feature. And with these calculations and the ones that opened, when they became that the outside was a CDA or some kind of self-consistent one, which was, then it became much more forgiving. If you just stop the cluster somewhere, you have to be very careful about the boundary being such that you didn't have too much bouncing back from this artificial feature. And that's probably the question of selecting the right clusters and having a self-consistent medium outside. If the medium is not self-consistent, then the boundary will hurt that at the numerical level.
Well, there is a very general fact that the error introduced by the medium boundary, the boundary between the medium cluster, when you make the cluster larger and larger, that error as seen in the central atom decreases rapidly, decreases differently in the metal and the insulator, but in both cases very rapidly. So that there's a general tendency. So if the experience has been general,
shell structure, yeah.
I'd like to come back to that
comment or remark since the super chain is marked by the parameter. I would rather expect it to be paramagnetic with different computations of the orbitals on those sides. So that on one left side you have the EG orbital occupied and the A1G orbital forming the spin 1, and on the other left side you have two electrons in the EG orbitals, and this will lead to a paramagnetic change. I think because the A1G occupation is very small, it's rather difficult to situation.
Well, that of course looks very much like the model of Mila for B2O3. And indeed, I agree with you that if there is an A1G electron floating around freely, shall we say, and three other electrons around, then that of course, just like in a double exchange model, would give you a ferromagnetic coupling. Also in the super exchange, but If the orbitals are the EG orbitals are occupied and the A1G is occupied a little bit, then the maximum type of exchange still will come from the A1G virtual excitations.
Yeah, but this virtual excitation will give a ferromagnetic super exchange if you have the orbital differences.
Only if you, well, it depends very much on what the true configurational fluctuations are. The way you described it, I agree with you.
Okay.
If those are the kinds of correlations
so
that you have.
So okay.
The interesting thing is to look, what are the correlations in that?
I think
process.
I'm going to cut you off.
Oh, you can switch it off, then I can shut up.
Okay, so we still have a short talk today before we can all enjoy the wine. And this is part of a few talks during this conference that deal with general methodological questions. This is a talk by Dr. Papa Constantopoulos about tight binding versus LDA plus U.